All right, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to my talk about Link to Anything, or it says everything over there, pretty much the same. My name is Bart De Smet. I'm a developer at Microsoft Corporation. I've been working in the Cloud Programmability team, which is physically located in the SQL organization, but we do other things as well, for the last 2.5 years, focusing on all kinds of data processing problems. How many of you were actually in my previous talk about Reactive? Okay, quite a few. Okay, thanks for coming again. So the people that actually went to my previous talk have actually seen one of the aspects, one of the many aspects of the things we've been working on, namely event processing. What I want to do in today's talk over here is talk a little bit more about the wide scope of things you can actually achieve using Link. It's based on a talk I've been doing for the last 3 years or something, but there's some new stuff in it as well. So if you've seen it before, you might see some content being repeated. Maybe it's a good refresher course. But we'll also talk about some of the most recent things we've actually been doing in the team. So let's actually set the scene a little bit. And in fact, that was the first slide I had to update when preparing for this talk. Initially, it said 5 years ago. In the meantime, it's already 7 years ago. This is the slide that Anders Halsberg used at PDC in 2005, I believe, talking about the project called Link, where we actually wanted to solve the impedance mismatch between different query domains and different languages, different front-end languages. So why do you need to learn things like XML query languages? Why do you need to learn things like SQL? Why do you need to learn, you name whatever kind of query language that you can dream up with or come up with in order to actually do querying from inside C# or VB? So we said let's actually introduce in C# and VB embedded query languages that actually talk to something called the standard query operators. So we have built-in support for things like filtering, selection, things like grouping, ordering, and you name it. So one of the things that you can see, though, is that the standard query operators, well, it's kind of a beautiful thing that they're kind of complete. Like, if you look at things like Haskell, where they've actually had, like, a lot of those operations on sequences for a long time, this is pretty much like a copy of that book, like the things that we have there. However, as we explore new domains, there are more query operators to be found. For example, in event processing systems, you have things that are based on time. And so it's still a good question to actually ask yourself whether there is more stuff we can do in that space. Obviously, because I'm the cloud programmability team, it's sort of in my commitments to have a cloud in at least every slide. So otherwise, I won't pass the performance test at the end of the year. So here's my cloud. But truthfully, the thing is, where's the cloud in this whole picture? Like, we have classic data stores, we have XML, we have relational databases, but there are lots of other data stores out there as well. So how does Link fit into those systems as well? So that's another question we actually want to answer here. And so in order to do so, I wanted to start by sort of, first of all, going really deep. You might argue I'm sort of like going 10 feet under the ground or something, but then we'll sort of, come out again and sort of reuse our core theoretical foundation to sort of see it's all the same. Like, Link applies to so many domains you can't believe it. Like, you wake up at night and you think, couldn't I do Link to, kitchen appliance or something? And maybe you can. So there's a lot of stuff to be found out here. So what I wanted to talk to you about, first of all, is this concept of a monad in functional programming. Unfortunately, a lot of stuff has been talked about it, and in fact, Simon Peyton-Jones, one of the inventors of Haskell, said, like, the one thing we did wrong with monads is give them a difficult name, so people are afraid of them. But the thing is, like, a monad is not that hard, and in fact, like, what's going on is that Link is really this monadic thing in disguise. So let me highlight a couple of things. What is it? Well, you get some mumbo-jumbo from type system theory here that says, like, a monad is constructed by having two operations, bind and return, which are very concrete. You will see them in just a second in Link. You've already seen them before without realizing it, most likely, and a type constructor M, which we already know as well. We'll see that in a moment. So that's the what. But why should we care? The thing is that monads have the promise that they allow you to chain actions together in a way to build something like a data processing pipeline. That's what it says over there, like processing rules, pipelines. Like, this article was written long before Link existed, and yet you recognize all of those things. Like, if you do where and select, you're building a pipeline for data operations. So there's something to be found here. And then finally, again, there is that data processing pipeline, but the way you actually use it is by composing functions. It's something that comes from the functional domain, the category theory domain, all of that stuff. So if mathematicians proved it right, it ought to be right. Like, those are much smarter than us programmers. So let's try to actually use everything they found out in the last, you know, hundreds of years and try to apply it to data processing. So Link does exactly that. Link is monads in disguise. Now, if you look over here, the first thing you need is a type constructor M. Type system of the CLR isn't quite sophisticated enough to have the notion of type constructors. In fact, Haskell does. But roughly compare it to IEnumerable of T, IQueryable of T, where you could actually substitute the thing in front of the of T for anything. So you could have something of T, where that something can be variable as well. That's sort of roughly how to think about it. So the regular question here, or the right question to ask, is could there be more than those two things we've already known, that we already know since .NET 3.5? The answer is definitely yes. For those of you who were in my talk about reactive, you've seen iObservable and iCubservable, two interfaces that I'll talk about here as well. So there are at least two more, but it turns out there are hundreds more that are still to be discovered. So let's actually talk about those in a moment as well. Now, we need two operations to be a monad. We need something to return. What's return? Return says, give me an A, and I return an M of A. M is that type constructor thing. Pick any of your choice, like the one that you like most. Let's say IEnumerable of T. So what does this thing do? It takes a T into an IEnumerable of T. How do you do that? You create an array that contains a single value. That's actually a valid implementation of a return for link to objects. Why do you care about that thing? The thing is, once you're in that world of a monad, you get lots of beautiful things. Like, it's like rainbows and unicorns and roses and all of those things. That's where you actually start composing your query operators to build beautiful pipelines. So you want to have an ability to basically get onto that train, to jump onto the ship. And that's what return gives you for single elements. It turns out to be a quite fundamental thing. Secondly, we need this piece of beauty called bind. Bind is the single most important operator in link. It's called differently. It's called select many. But what it does is give me an M of A, something that's already on the ship. And then give me a function to transform the thing that's in there onto an M of B, and I can give you an M of B back. Well, what does that mean? Say you have an IEnumerable of products, and you have a function to go from a product to an IEnumerable of orders. Link to objects can give you an IEnumerable of orders, which are the orders for all the products in your database. It's a join. You can do very similar things for event processing systems, all of those guys. Select many is the single guy that's actually the most powerful. And the beauty of it is you can't fall off the cliff. You start in M of A, you end up in M of B. You haven't lost the M on the way. The only thing you get in select many is a little bubble of safety where they say, I will fish something out for you. Here's a product. Please give me a list of orders back. And as soon as you do that, they wrap it again into an IEnumerable. So essentially, you get this little safety island where you can look at the elements in the sequence, but you don't take them out. And so that's what select many gives you. And in fact, the signature of select many, if you substitute T for A, IEnumerable for M, R for B, you have exactly the same thing, just in a different notation. So Wikipedia already knew about link long time ago, so it ought to be interesting. In fact, you can look at one of my old projects on CodePlex called LinkSQO that implements a lot of link, including things like where and select and order by. Lots of those operations can be implemented in terms of select many. Reader, exercise left for the reader tonight at the bar, in the hotel, or whatever. Try to implement where using select many. And if somebody asks what you're doing, it's a good conversation starter, believe me. So let's actually try to build something using this, starting with something academic, and then we'll get into something more real. The maybe monad, that's one of those little things that have existed in functional languages for a long time. It in fact tries to solve the problem of null propagation. Say you don't know what the value is of something, and you still want to do computation. Well, you want to do something like x.y.z.foo.bar.quux.whatever, and all of those things can be null. Well, good luck with that. Like, you have to have null checks everywhere, right? So with monads, you can propagate null checking. And so this is what I want to do here. I want to implement the mythical null-propagating dot in C#, which doesn't exist and people have asked for it, but then you need null-propagating delegate invocation and null-propagating operator overloads and null-propagating everything, and I think Anders doesn't quite like that aspect of it. So we don't have the null-propagating dot today. Maybe in a future release we may have it. Now, the beauty of this is if you go into the compiler's team's office and you ask, how would you implement this thing? They start talking mumbo-jumbo of IL instructions. We'll just do a branch false. If this thing is null, we'll go there and then bypass the rest of the expression, blah, blah, blah. Like, we could also do something totally different as opposed to translating this into machine code instructions. We could say, let's do a syntactic translation. Like in C# 5.0 and C# 4.0 and C# 3.0, a lot of the features, almost all of the features that we did, are implemented in terms of C# 2.0 primitives. Link is just method calls in disguise with anonymous methods and expression trees. Like, it sort of boils down to core primitives. So what if we actually desugar null-propagating dots into link queries? We have that in C# 3. Say null-propagating dots we want to add in C# 43. Like, why don't we use something we already have for a long time, right? And so that's my proposal, how to implement null-propagation. From underscore in name, from s in underscore dot to upper, select s. That looks kind of suspicious. What's the secret here? The secret is that this syntax translates into a select many call. And because it's a select many call, you can now implement your null propagation as a library function. You don't have to change the compiler that much. You don't have to change the IL generation. So let me actually show you this in practice with a little demo here. So, and then we'll get to things that are more interesting in terms of daily use, but this sort of shows the power of link in some way. I think I just took the wrong machine. Let me retry this. Ah, there we go. Beautiful. Maybe, baby. Let's try this. Good. So let's open this guy in VS 11 beta. It's actually RC, but the shortcut menu is sort of messed up, apparently. And so what I have here is my hypothetical compiled code for the thing you saw on the slide. So if the user writes name question dot to upper, the idea is if name is null, the whole thing needs to be default of whatever to upper returns. So it needs to be null, because like to upper doesn't want to null ref. That's the whole idea of having a null propagating concept. So I want to translate it like this. Now, look at this. I don't have system link sitting here, yet I can write this. Shouldn't be a surprise to any of you, because you all know that select many is just method calls in disguise. Now, the beauty is that the compiler doesn't care where it finds those methods. The way we find those methods over here is by actually having an extension method on anything that's a class, anything that can be null. So I have an extension method, select many, that appears on every object, right? And that takes in a function, which is the selector. Link translates, this link syntax translates into a selector function that includes this underscore, and then actually draws an arrow, a lambda arrow, to this part. So there's a function hidden here. This thing is really what gets passed over here into the selector function. So as you can see, now that I have this, it will call select many. It will actually bind to this method, and in here, I can do a null check. If the value passed in is null, I'm not going to call that selector, because then underscore would be null and to upper would throw. I don't want that to happen. So I'm now going to lift all of my processing rules about how to deal with null propagation into the monad. That's what the monad does. It hides one particular implementation detail. And link to object, the implementation detail is nested for each loops. Like for each over one thing, for each over the other thing, yield return. That's what it really hides. In this case, what we want to hide is this null check. And so let me actually show you that this actually works, because you don't have to believe me. So here we go. Name is Bart. I do F10. I will do F11 over here. There we go. F11 on a link statement brings us into select many. The compiler just was binding against this particular overload of select many. And value is Bart. It's not null. So I can actually call my result selector function. And over there you go. When you do F11 again, you're stepping into another piece of code that was part of your link query. Like, you can just step into this little fragments of this link query. It's not a secret how this is implemented at all. So you see, there's Bart. Bart will come out. I will do another F11. This is also a hidden function, a function in disguise. This like return R thing, because I have the underscore and scope here as well. So this also generates a function. And so I get uppercase Bart here, and there we go, there's uppercase Bart. Now if I actually would go here and make this default of string, I'm actually in the club of the verifiers. Like, you know, I like to use var everywhere, so my type always appears on the right-hand side. So this is actually a null string. If I do F11 here, the value that's the left-hand side of my select many call is null, so I will bail out early, because if I would call the selector, I would null F. So the null propagation is working, as you can see. Now this is not what you want to write for sure, but this is what the hypothetical syntax could compile into using something we already have, namely link, which is really monads. So here you go, you get null back. So of course, you know, this is not the kind of thing you want to do at work, most likely. So let's actually get to some things that are arguably slightly more real. And let's talk about some more data processing systems. So how many of you have tried to implement iQueryable of T? One person. Did you like it? No. Okay. Okay, that's what I wondered. And actually, I have two recipes here today that make your life easier. One is the first one I will show here that will ultimately lead to link to Twitter. And then I will also show you a sampler of some provider toolkit kind of thing we've been noodling around with internally. So let's start with this particular sample here. I simply have a query that is a where and a group by over a source of products, right? What do you think this should do if I tell you that it compiles fine? It should produce results, right? Unfortunately, as you run this thing, the link provider happens not to support group by. And so what you get is this beautiful exception that says the compiler wasn't smart enough to figure it out. We found it later. So here's your, you know, your luck is sort of running out today. And you've just written your beautiful query. Everything was compiling fine. And in fact, if you ask Haskell people, if they compile it, they ship it. They don't even run it. Like, if it compiles, it's correct, right? Like, it's so good in terms of type checking. Now, by the way, don't do that at home. But that's an often a joke that's made quite often. So this isn't quite the case in languages like C#, and it's definitely not the case in weakly typed languages like JavaScript, where if you don't run it, chances are that it doesn't run. In fact, it almost never runs for me. So what's wrong with this? The thing is that source of product implements iQueryable. What does that mean? If you implement iQueryable, you get all of link, whether you like it or not. And that's good for the end user. The end user sees, group by, and order by, and select, and this and that. But then the poor link provider implementer says, I don't know how to deal with group by. I have to throw an exception here. And so can't we make this into a compile time check? And so the answer is, well, we can. If you look at this, this is just syntactic sugar over method calls, as we've seen before. So this talks compiles into a dot where and a dot select passing in some lambdas. That's pretty simple stuff. But nobody said in the specification of C# that those things have to be extension methods, like they happen to be unenumerable and iQueryable. They can also be instance methods. So you can actually sort of hold the compiler by its hand by basically having a source that has a where method. And then the where method returns a bar, and bar has a select method. And select returns a foo that has a group by method. And the foo returns, you get the idea. Basically, by doing, you know, by creating types for all the intermediate stages of your query, you can actually get compile time checking. So this is what I'm doing here. Sources of type source of T. It doesn't implement iQueryable of T. It has a where method that returns a filtered of T. The filtered of T has a select method that returns a projected of T, but it doesn't have a group by method. Hence, the compiler will actually draw red squigglies. I don't know what you mean. You were using the group by keyword, but I couldn't find a group by method. Like, it's not going to do something weird to try to cook up a method or something. Like, it's just going to tell you a compile time error. Now, this only works for very constrained query languages, but the beauty is that a lot of query languages are darn stupid. Like, if you look at the Facebook query language and the Twitter query language and, like, all those query languages that you have there, typically they do where and a select, maybe some, you know, sampling if it's like a real-time stream. They don't do that much. So you might actually be able to use this technique for things that aren't as complicated as relational databases, for example. And we'll talk about those database systems in a moment as well. So that's one technique, and I will show it in just a second in the slides, or not in slides, in a demo. But we can take it even further. What about this experience? From tweet and Twitter, where tweet dot, that's beautiful, about, from, and location. I can filter on those guys. User is happy, the dot actually produced stuff. So the user types from equals Bart, and writes another where class, where tweet dot, oh my goodness, I only see about and location, and I didn't change IntelliSense. How did you do that? The answer is it's always been in the C# spec since day 1.0. It just happens that those things are instance methods that are lying about the type of tweet. The different occurrences of tweet in this query have a different type, and I will show you in just a second how that works. Kind of mind-boggling. It just happens to work. So I can do where tweet.about equals link, and then I could do where tweet.location equals Amsterdam, and then I could do where tweet dot, and I wouldn't see anything anymore. Like, you can totally do that today without changing Visual Studio or anything. So let's see how it works. That's the recipe. Excessive method overloading can be harmful, but in the US they always have those labels on all sorts of medicines, like if you take this too much it can be harmful. Like, with method overloading, that's kind of the same thing, or operator overloading. Type state machine, we're actually going to build a state machine of types that guides you to that query, and we'll show that in just a moment. And I already said the method overloads and the operator overloads. So what's going on here? Twitter is of type Twitter, just with a capital T. Okay? And Twitter has a where method that looks as follows. It takes in a func that takes in a tweet about from lock, and it returns a filter from. What's that tweet about from lock? And doesn't where have to return a Boolean? The answer is no. C# doesn't freaking care whether it returns a Boolean or, like, you know, a person object. Where is just something that happens to have the shape of a function that takes in one thing and returns one thing. So you can overload that with something else, and the compiler will bind to it without complaining. Okay, so let's try that. What's that tweet about from lock thing? Tweet about from lock is a type that has three properties for the sake of simplicity, here abbreviated to public fields. So you have three things there, and they don't even return system.string. They return a from string, an about string, and a lock string, location string. What do those things do? A from string has an operator overload that can compare the from string with a typical BCL system.string, and it returns a filter from. Guess what? If you write tweet.from equals Bart, you've just guided the compiler to take, you know, a from string, do an operator overload resolution, and actually return a filter from. This thing binds to this overload. That's beautiful. Now, what do we have? We just know from this whole thing that the user has written a filter on the from class, on the from part of a tweet. So why don't we encode that in the return type? Why don't we say Twitter by from? This means that that whole thing, the first two lines of the link query, have as a type a Twitter by from. Now you can guess what I'm going to do next, right? The Twitter by from has actually a where method on it, again an instance method, no need for extension methods here, that in the function takes in a tweet about lock, no longer a from part, returns a filter about, and so you see that there are only two properties left. So when you dot into that thing, you will actually see the IntelliSense for this guy. So you actually have reduced this whole thing, and now what we're going to return if the compiler chooses this overload, we're actually going to return a Twitter by about from, which will then have a type that only has location on it, and so forth. So this is kind of a neat little trick that you can play for domains that are very constrained. Like, this doesn't work for some large database systems where you have lots of, you know, combinatorial explosion of all the operations that people can do. But for a lot of those silly domains, like, you know, the IMDb movie database I will show you right now, you can totally use this technique. So let's take a look at a silly query domain called IMDb. And so open this thing and take a look at what's going on here. I have a query sitting here from movie in IMDb, where movie.title equals Titanic, where movie.year equals 1997, select the movie. right? Let me show you how the experience looks like if I wouldn't have this. Let's do where, movie dot, title and year, as well as some things from system.object. So let's do where title equals Titanic, where movie dot, that's nice, the title has gone, because I've already used it, no need to filter on it twice. So now I can do year equals 1997. Let me do another where, movie dot, no response, nothing's happening here. Movie dot actor equals Bart, I'm a famous film star now. Like, as you can see over here, it says, like, I couldn't find a where method anymore. You've used all your bullets here. Like, you've shot the whole query domain, like, full of bullet holes. Like, there is no shot left in the barrel. So, as you can see, this is basically guiding you through. Now, you might actually wonder one thing. This says system.link. I'm using a for each over here. What does that mean? If I have a for each, couldn't you imply something from that? And some people incorrectly imply from this whole piece of code, and I don't know why IMDb is still squiggly, but the for each keyword here sort of seems to imply that the result is actually an IEnumerable. If it's an IEnumerable and I have system.link imported, shouldn't I see all the methods anyway? Shouldn't I be able to dot into this result and see order by? It's not happening. This thing implies it's an enumerable and it doesn't show up. Where's the problem in the reasoning here? The answer is for each doesn't freaking care it's an IEnumerable. It just says, if you have a getEnumerator which returns an object that has a move next and a current, I'm happy, I will bind to it. Has been so since C# 1.0. So this thing doesn't have to implement IEnumerable of T to be enumerable using the for each keyword. Just like await, for example, in C# 5.0 is based on a pattern of having a get awaiter and is completed and so forth. So you can overload all of those things. As I like to say, you can overload the crap out of it. So let's actually take a look at what's going on. IMDb has this where method that takes in a movie query title year, which is a movie that has a title any year, as you can see. And it returns a year filter. How can you build a year filter? Well, if you dot into the movie query title year inside your where class, and you dot into year, you get a movie year, and the movie year has an operator overload that compares it to an int, returning a year filter. There's your answer. Like, you can get to this overload by simply doing year equals 1997. Like, it just resolves to that guy. And so, the same, of course, for this thing over here. Now, as you shall see over here, as I walk through this, like you do a where based on the year and you do a where based on, over here, the title and the year, ultimately what you get back is a movie enumerable. Movie enumerable. It's not an IEnumerable though. Like I told you that before, if it would be an IEnumerable, the floodgates would be open. You could do a group by and all sorts of things that the remote query provider can't support. So movie enumerable is not an IEnumerable, because we don't want link to objects to interfere with our intentions here. Instead, what it is an object that happens to have a getEnumerator, so the for each keyword happens to work. And at that point, we actually take up all the user intent, all the filters that the user wrote, we actually intercepted all of those operator overloads, and we can build a query string over here. And that's what we do, and we actually print it to the console in case we have logging enabled. So this query translates into Titanic and year equals 1997. This is linked to a URL query string. Like, that's just the way this particular service happens to work. In fact, it's not even IMDb service. It's a service of somebody who was motivated in the evening, had nothing else to do, and actually wrote an HTML screenscraper kind of thing on top of it that supports a mini query language for, like, the year and the title. So that's kind of neat. So, by the way, one thing we always do in case we do those kind of things is we also have an asEnumerable method that allows you to sort of jump ship, to say, like, I know everything I'm doing here works on the server, but now I still want to group those guys or sort them. Like, I want to have all the movies from 1997 and I want to order them by actor or something. Like, you can do explicitly asEnumerable, which returns an IEnumerable, and I have a little anonymous enumerable type here that just implements the IEnumerable for me. But so as I go here, I can still do an asEnumerable. I can't do a where anymore because I've already used the two wheres that are available. but I can do an as enumerable dot, and there's the whole of link to objects. In here, you have an explicit watermark that says everything on top can be remoted, everything at the bottom will run locally. You want that thing to be explicit. You don't want to sort of switch on behalf of the user, because then you don't have transparency, or you do have transparency of remoting, which isn't generally a bad thing, especially if large volumes of data are involved. So this actually shows how to deal with constrained query domains that still have a query language. And you might be surprised to see how many query languages are out there. The biggest source of query languages is your browser URL string. Like, whenever you navigate to Facebook, take a look at the URL and say, can I make a link provider for this thing? Like, I can guarantee you, you have endless source of fun right there. So this does work for constrained queries. Constrained query domains, by which I mean you only support a where and a select or something, or a few other things, maybe an order by. And maybe, you know, the domain of the objects is also fixed. Like, in Twitter, there are tweets. In Facebook, there are wall posts. Like, you already know all of those entities. So you can sort of afford to have, like, custom string types, like, you know, a year string and a title string, to do all of this interception and hooking using operator overloading. But, like, this doesn't work at all if you have something like link to SQL. Like, you still want to have CLR data types at the end of the day there. And typically, you have much more capabilities that you're almost starting to clone everything that's in system.string anyway. So in that case, you want to go for a different approach. And so this is something that's been cooking in the oven that we're using internally for a number of our properties now. Is like, if you still have to go to expression trees, and you have to recognize expression trees, and those of you who've actually built query providers using iQuery will know that's a big task, like using visitors and all sorts of things that you don't want to see. In case you still have to go down that route because you're doing something like link to SQL, can't we make it easier for you to actually match over those expression trees? Like, as opposed to doing like recursive descent recognition of all those things. Like, you know, it's a lot of plumbing you have to do. So what we have is this thing that's based on a paper from, I believe it's 1992, called Burg. It's a bottom-up rewrite system that recognizes patterns in expression trees and can tile trees based on certain rules. And based on those tilings, you can actually convert the expression tree into a different shape. So what I want to do here is I want to take a link expression tree, feed it with a rule database that says, like, if you see a substring, use the substar function in T-SQL, and so on and so forth. That's in that database kind of thing, which is just an in-memory kind of piece of IL code. And then on the right-hand side, what I want to get out is a T-SQL expression tree that has T-SQL-specific query operations. And of course, you can substitute T-SQL for anything else here. So what we have is a little tool that I hope we can publish anytime soon. Well, not too soon, but at some point, because we're still cooking it and using it for a lot of our internal assets. But I sort of want to give you a sampler of it. So what you do is you basically give this thing, and this is sort of more like an implementation detail here, but what you give it is the thing on the left. You give it a lot of rules that say, if you see something, a node of type int, do something with it. Translate it to a SQL int. Like, you know, a .NET int becomes a SQL int, so you can do type checking in all those domains. Next, if you see an addition between two unknowns, A and B, two wildcards, like you see a plus with two subtrees, no matter how big they are, like, what you need to do is you need to recursively descend into those guys and select a rule that ultimately combines the results of that recursive visit into something that's an add operation in T-SQL. So you're basically saying in the CLR, it's the plus operator. In SQL, it's a T-SQL expression tree that uses plus. Of course, for plus, that's trivial. But for things like substring, there might be lots more voodoo going on. Next, you do the same thing for multiplication, for example, and there's some little details here. But you build up a table that makes it very efficient to tile that tree. Like, the efficiency of that is something you can actually read all about in the paper by Todd Prebstring. I can actually share the name if you're interested later on. And finally, this is actually not going to T-SQL, but this is a hypothetical translation of an expression tree of arithmetic expressions into some machine language. In this case, the machine language supports an addition and a multiplication. Okay? So that's things that my calculator can do. but it also has a built-in primitive in its runtime that supports an addition and a multiplication bundled together, because that's more efficient in terms of how the CPU works. So what I want to do is, if I recognize something that looks like a plus with a multiplication here and an addition over there, I want to basically go for this rule because it's less costly. This is a cost-based optimization mechanism. So I won't talk too much about all of that costing, but the idea is that you can recognize big patterns. You can recognize things like a substring with a 2 upper and a 2 lower. Like, you know, you can write a rule for that, and we'll actually visit a tree, and if we see that thing, we'll activate your rule so that you can rewrite it. So we basically do the tiling for you. So what happens now, and there's another node called inc, if you do anything plus 1, there is an instruction in my target language that knows how to do plus 1. Like you have plus plus in C and C++, right? Or all the derived languages for that matter. So what's going to happen now is if I feed it an expression tree, it's going to tile it as efficiently as possible based on this cost-based optimization, and it's going to basically invoke your rules to rewrite those guys. So here it's actually looking at that tree and it sees, well, you did a multiplication between two things and you did an addition with 1. So what's the most cost-effective way of tiling this thing? Well, we might actually choose from our rule table an add with a multiplication and an add plus 1, or we might use the add multing, which does all of that for free, or we might do a multiplication followed by an inc because we did plus 1. Like plus 1 is like plus anything else, but maybe this rule is cheaper. So like this whole thing allows you to actually do all of that stuff automatically on your behalf. You don't have to worry about all those rules, which if you do it using a manual visitor, you're sitting there and you're looking at a binary expression and you see, I see a plus. Now I need to look at my left-hand side whether it's not by accident a multiplication. And the right-hand side, if that thing happens to be a daytime offset.now subtract milliseconds or something, like I'm just making up something here, like I need to do this. And if it looks like this, I need to do something totally different. Like, you need to have all that state in your visitor. That's way too mind-boggling. This thing is basically rule-based. So let me give you an example of where we use that right now. So I'm going to implement a link provider here using a rule-based system. And so I'm going to use this project called Burse. And I'm first going to show you the academic samples. I always like to have an academic sample sitting somewhere. And so the academic samples are here. So my program will actually use the academic samples. And the academic demo looks like this. It does a lot of things because there's a lot of things to show here. I will just show you one. Let's actually go for, I will show you two. Arithmetic to calc instruction set is what you saw on the slides. This is all it takes to actually tile an expression tree in the most efficient manner. What you say is, this heavily uses collection initializer syntax in C#3.0. So it looks a lot like JSON. Like this whole thing is one expression. Like, you know, it says new bottom-up rewriter with a lot of generic parameters, and then curly brace, object initializer syntax with collection initializers inside. Take a look at the rules table. The rules table says, if you see an addition node in my source language over two things, at cost $2, you can translate it into a plus instruction. If you see a multiplication at cost 3, you can translate it into a times instruction. This might be your instruction set of your hand calculator, okay? If you see an addition that contains a multiplication, you can go to a times plus operation at cost 4. That's typically cheaper than doing an add and a plus and a times together, because that gives you a combined cost of 5. So this thing is more optimal. And if you see an add that does x plus a constant value of 1, there happens to be a built-in primitive in the CPU that can do that really efficiently. It's called inc for increment at cost 1. So you basically give it that thing, and then as soon as you have this burst thing, here's an expression tree. That's the expression tree from the slide. 2 times 3 add 1, multiply that whole thing with the multiplication of 4 and 5, and add constant 6. So this is 2 times 3 plus 1, in between parentheses, times 4 times 5, plus 6. That's basically the notation just in an expression tree shape. So you have that whole thing sitting there. Now all you do is you feed that whole thing to burst.rewrite, and what you get back is a calc instruction. That's the most efficient tiling of that whole expression tree. And so if I would run that thing, it would actually evaluate the source language and the target language, and hopefully they produce the same result. Otherwise, something is totally broken, right? So this is actually the arithmetic instruction set sample. Here we go. It actually dumps some diagnostic information as well. But so as you can see, the source language is printed here. That's exactly the same thing as my C-sharp code. The two-string happens to create something that looks very similar. That's my input. Then we have a label tree. We go through a lot of like analysis of the tree, so we have to label things. That's an implementation detail. But then here you have the result. It chose to do a times plus with an increment, with a times and another times. That's likely the thing that produced the least cost. So that's the most official tiling of this whole thing. Now, you may be wondering, where does this come in useful, right? So a couple of things. You can also build optimizers using that go from one expression tree to another. So for example here, I took up high school logic, simple proposition logic, and I said not true equals false, not false equals true, not is void. Something and true is something. Something and false is false. True and something, blah, blah, blah. Like all the rules that you get from a textbook, you give it to Burst, and it just does like optimal tiling of that thing. So you can also write optimizers. Here I have the Morgan's rules as well. Like if it sees a negation of two negations with an and between, it knows how to turn it around at the cost of one. So like this can actually tile trees and do all sorts of rewrites, whether it's for optimization purposes or anything else. Okay? Now, where does it come in useful? I've done a little prototype recently of Link to Hive. That's the query language that we actually have in Hadoop, okay? The big data solution for MapReduce jobs. So there you actually deal with any kind of type. It's sort of as powerful as Link to SQL in some sense. You can have arbitrary types, in this case weather station data, that happens to contain a station name, an absolute value. You can use absolute values in there. It's beautiful. You can use so many things in a query language, and there is a Hive equivalent, just like there is T-SQL equivalents for lots of those things. Like, you can do meaningful things like, you know, the absolute value of a temperature, or even worse things, like, for example, computing the sine of a temperature, which is really meaningful value. So just to show you that you can write those things, but if you do it using an expression tree visitor, good luck. Like you see a method call expression. Now you need to match the method call expression. Does it happen to be met.sine? Does it happen to be met.cosine? And you have all those switch statements everywhere, and typically people don't even match correctly because there are overloads to those guys. If you match them on name, you might actually have a false positive. Like the user wrote the met.sine over decimals. I don't know whether it exists, but if it exists, like maybe that's not something that Hive supports. So like, you know, you have to do a lot of things. So how is this thing implemented? I'm not going to show you the whole implementation here, but I'm going to show you over here the Hive translator that has the burst table in it. That's literally go to this URL, which is the language syntax for Hive, and just dump it in a big table. X equals null becomes a Hive node that is a null check. No, equality checks are binary nodes. Like you basically, the right-hand side here is an AST for Hive. It's a domain-specific tree implementation for the target language, okay? So that knows about things that C-sharp doesn't know about, like it's a specialized domain. So you have this big table sitting here where you sort of add a lot of things, and we'll actually tile the tree by looking at all those rules and try to find the covering. And then the result will be a Hive tree. So let me actually try to run it over here. If I run this piece of code, I want Hive to come out, right? And so there we go. As you can see, you actually get Hive out, which is blah, 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 over here, an exception. That's not quite Hive, right? The exception says I found an equality method call that I didn't know how to deal with. Okay. So if you do a classic expression tree visitor, that means crack open the code and try to find where I need to recognize the equality check. Where do I need to add a case for a method info comparison to do the right thing? So you crack open the entire thing. In this case, it says, well, let me take a look at the code again, right? Let me take a look at what the user wrote here. The user wrote station.station.equals. What's this dot equals? Ah, that's a system.string.equals. You know, it's a good pop quiz, actually, tonight at the bar again, is like, name one more way to do string comparison in .NET. Ah, string.equals, string.compare, string.this, string.that. Like, there's so many ways you can do string identity checks or string equality checks. It's unbelievable. If you use VB, there's even helper methods called compiler services dot, you know, I don't know what it's called, compare string or something. Like, they bind to a different method altogether because VB has slightly different semantics in the way it deals with system string comparisons. So, like, a lot of those things are happening there. So how can I fix that? The fix happens to be you go into a table somebody wrote before the demo and commented out one of the rules. So I'm just, you know, enabling this one rule again that says if I see two strings and the user wrote L dot equals R, I know how to translate that to Hive. I will translate it by creating a binary expression in the Hive domain that uses the equality node type. So I'm basically just adding that one rule to the table, and now my query will compile. I don't have to crack open that whole thing. I just missed one case here. When I do Control F5, ah, there you go. That's valid HQL, hopefully, Hive syntax for this particular thing. So you create your target domain AST, which is just like a lot of objects, right? Like class expression tree with like subclasses for binary and unary and ternary. Like you build all of those things. You implement the right interfaces, which is our I3 of T implementation we have, and then you can use burst on top of that to translate between two domains. So table-driven translation, pretty useful technique. So this is something that's in the oven, and we're using for a number of our internal assets at this point. So we're still dog-fooding it in some sense and finding a lot of interesting quirks we didn't even know about. Like, for example, in C#, if you do a plus between different strings up to like four strings being added, it uses string.join. At a later point in time, it tries to create a binary tree that covers your string.joins. At a later point in time, it does something else. So like the associativity of those things might be weird. And so like as you start adding rules to that table, you sort of see like, oh, I didn't know C# generated that code. So that's kind of, you know, an interesting learning experience as well. So what's more? A few things. So we've talked about creating query providers in different ways, like link to Twitter, using that, like take the compiler by its hand and guide it to the world of type systems by doing operator overloading and all of that stuff. We've seen how to use those new techniques like burst that we're sort of cooking in the oven today. But there are different things as well. This is actually a pretty reactive slide. I didn't know there was an animation left in it, so I'll have to talk through it. But this thing actually shows that to do queries over data domains, there are different ways you can get to the data. And that's what we've already seen if you went to my previous talk, is in reactive extensions, the data that comes to your application comes in a different fashion, or comes in a different mechanism. What's the difference? In the classic enumerable world, what's going on is that you are in control. You are saying, move next, please give me the next element. And then the database is fetching something and you get an element and you can get stuck while that's happening. In the world of iObservable, you say, please tell me whenever something interesting happens, when the stock price went up, when there is somebody tweeting about me. Like you're basically saying, this is my query, notify me, push some data at me in a callback when things are happening. And so that's what reactive extensions covers for. Based on, and that's a slide that's, I believe, the only slide that I stole from my previous presentation. But the idea there is you have observable sequences which allow you to subscribe to them. So you can say, I'm interested in getting callbacks whenever something happens. And that's what we call an observer. An observer is the callback. So you basically hook up using subscribe, saying, notify me when the stock price changes, for example. And then data gets pushed at you in the future, asynchronously. Your program can continue doing other things while that thing is in flight. And at some point, your application will have to react to the data coming in. And the way to do that is, of course, using link. So let's take a look. Those are the interfaces. I've sort of talked through them. The idea is iObserver is a callback interface. You can get called back. And observable is the thing that you actually use to walk up to a data store and say, please call me back. So that's the place where you do the subscription. So you say subscribe to the NASDAQ Stock Exchange, which is an iObservable of StockTick, and you basically give it an observer. What you get back is a disposable that you can use to actually unsubscribe at some point. So let's take a look at what this has brought to the table in Link. I saw a gentleman trying to take a picture. This is not a Windows 8 blue screen, just saying. Like, if you tweet about it, like, you know, this is actually the PowerPoint background. So let's take a look at what this has added to the picture in terms of, like, ways you can manipulate data using Link. So we have an axis that I call the what axis. The what axis is basically what the mode is of acquiring the data. Are you dealing with a pull-based system, which we call interactive? Are you dealing with a reactive system that's push-based? So you've seen in the previous slide that we have I observable of T, and in my previous talk, you basically have link to events. You can now write filters and sampling and all sorts of things on top of events. So that's I observable of T. Those are related by a mathematical property called duality. If you want to learn everything about that, we have like hours of video coverage on channel 9 where we sort of talk through that repeatedly. So I'm not going to do it anymore because I've gotten sick of it myself. So if you want to learn more, you can find out. But those two things are deeply related. They're mirror images of each other, which means everything you can do on the left, you can sort of do on the right as well. So that's beautiful to know. Now, the second aspect is where work happens in the system. People that actually went to my previous talk have seen that in order to introduce reactive programming, we had to come up with a notion of schedulers. Schedulers say, you know, if you have to run a timer, for example, to do sampling of an event stream, where do you want that timer to happen? Do you want it to happen on a thread, on a worker pool? Do you want it to happen distributed, maybe in a cloud context? Maybe you can actually scale those things out to do MapReduce jobs or something. So that's what the scheduler is about. Now, here's the third axis, and that's maybe the surprising axis. That's the axis about how. And people traditionally believe that this axis is about where. I just said that where is about schedulers. So what do I mean with the how axis? The how axis is how the query is represented. Is the query represented using IL code, because you used link to objects and you wrote like a delegate in disguise when you were writing a where filter, or is the expression tree, whoops, I revealed the secret here. Oh my goodness, what did I do? Sorry. You didn't see that. But so at the top of this slide, you have something called translatable. The fourth quadrant is what the secret is. So translatable means that the query gets captured not as IL code, because that's like, you know, instructions that are kind of hard to understand again. Instead, what we want to do is we want to capture the user intent as an expression tree so we can translate it into some other domain. And we've traditionally had in there iQueryable of T and link to SQL, right? Those two domains, fixed and translatable, are related to a property called homoiconicity, which was introduced in Lisp a long time ago. It means that you write the thing exactly the same. There is no syntactic difference. That's the homo part and the icon part, the same shape. Yet, it executes in a different way. In Lisp, that's called quotations. So you can actually represent the list as a data structure or in a different manner. So that's what the homoiconicity means. So what's new? Why can't you do this whole thing on event streams as well? Why can't you pick up a query that says, like, filter the things in Twitter and run that whole thing in Twitter by taking up the expression tree and run it somewhere else? Now, the somewhere else may sound like it's about the where, but it's actually about the how. It's about who's going to take responsibility of interpreting the instruction stream. How is it executing? It happens that for a lot of those things, those two concepts like where and how are conflated. In SQL, you happen to translate and you happen to ship the T-SQL to a different machine. It's not running in the same process. But you could totally do something in the same process as well. So like the where aspect is really orthogonal to the how. And we'll talk about that in a little bit as well. So this new interface we have is called iQobservable. That's not a typo. That's by intent. Story went, we were actually hacking, Eric Meyer and myself, in a building somewhere in downtown Bellevue to be away from the office. We were trying to find out a good name, and we said, like, you know, those two things, iObservable and iQobservable, are related by homoiconicity, which means everything the user writes looks exactly the same. He writes a where keyword and a select keyword. It's exactly the same. Like, there's no difference whatsoever. Let's make the types look the same as well, because nobody has to see them. Like, the only guy who has to see them is the guy implementing the query provider, which is one in a million. And those people are delighted to see a little joke in the framework sometimes. So ikeObservable is iObservable with a little line in it. If I would take this joke a little further, of course iQueryable would have to be called ifNumerable, which is iNumerable missing a leg. But we can't change it anymore. And I'm actually not on the naming committee, so likely that wouldn't go through. So what we have here is the same thing as iQueryable. Looks very much the same. The only difference, well, there are some differences, but the commonality, let's start with that. The commonality is it captures an expression tree, which represents the entire user intent. So you can look at it as a data structure, feed it to my burst thing I showed before, translate it to whatever language you want to translate it to. There are a couple of differences, though. That's for those of you who've actually built query providers before. The ikeObservable provider has some additional roles. Let's not talk about it here today. I have a whole channel line video about that. But it acts sometimes as a mediator between different parties. And it also, and that's maybe the one I will talk about a little bit, it doesn't have an execute method. The iQuery provider, which is used for iEnumerable, has an execute method. What does the execute method do? It says, give me an expression tree, and give me a type, like say, execute of r, give me an expression tree, and I will return a freaking r to you. Where is that used? Say you do an aggregate, an average in T-SQL. Then we call that guy. What's the problem with that guy? The execute method. It's synchronous. You call like, please give me the average for like all my product prices. And then you're blocking till that thing happens. Now, you don't want that to happen when you say like, I want to get like, you know, the average stock price of the stock exchange for Microsoft today. Does that mean your program has to be stuck for 24 hours or how long the stock exchange is open? No, you still want to get an iObservable back that happens to contain a single value that tells you what the average is when the stock exchange closes at the end of the day. So you want to stay in the monad. That comes all the way back to the beginning. Execute went from iEnumerable or iQueryable of T to T. It left the iQueryable world. It needs to be punished, right? Like, because once you leave that world, you're basically saying goodbye to the unicorns and, you know, all the rainbows and the sunshine that you had in that wonderful land. In the case of Rx, the unicorn is asynchrony. Like, you can't block using Rx. You don't want to block when you do an aggregate. Like, you just want to hook up a continuation. Maybe you want to await it in C# 5.0. You can do that today in Rx as well. So that's really why we don't have an execute method. So let's actually show an example, namely link to Twitter. I'll switch over here. Oh, my goodness. Okay. There's a button here that says effect. Like, maybe there will be special effects on the screen later on. I pressed that one by mistake. If you see special effects, let me know. Okay, let's go back over here. In fact, it's in the same project. Just by accident, I happened to put it in the same project. If I go to the playground over here, I have something called DataSift. And DataSift is, if I could go to the internet over here, DataSift, Data On Demand, is basically a social media aggregation platform. It actually aggregates all the streams of Twitter, Facebook, and you basically pay for play. So basically you have a subscription there and you say, I want to have so many events a second at most, I will do some query, and depending on how complex the query is, the cost-based optimizations that they have to do and the number of data points that they actually have to keep actually either cost you more money or not. You know, your credit card can actually be pretty empty at the end of the day if you play too much with this thing. But you know, the beauty is like you can basically query anything. Anything that's actually like social media streams. So what I have here is a DataSift demo that actually does this. I have a SIFT stream, which is a data stream that comes from there. It's a SIFT stream of Twitter, so I want to have tweets, but I could also do Facebook wall posts or something. And now I want to do something like where the tweet.user.follower count is larger or equal to 10, and the tweet contains the word good. I want to get notifications when that happens. So I do select tweet. This whole query will be translated into, of course, you know, every online provider today has to have their own query language. No different for DataSift, they invented their own query language. So we're actually taking this where predicate and sending it off to the DataSift infrastructure where they can execute it as efficiently as they wish to. Then at the end of the day, another thing I'm doing here is as observable. Again, as we've seen before, there's always a way to go back to local execution, a high watermark, by which you say everything on top of that needs to run remotely. If it weren't running remotely, what would happen is you would get the whole Twitter stream onto your machine, which isn't really a good idea. So I want to leave the where filter remotely, but then I want to use some other things here. In particular, I want to do JSON parsing, because this thing gives me a stream of JSON objects. You know, they give me JSON. Like, I can't run the parsing over there. Like, they're still returning me JSON. So I have to run certain things locally, certain things remotely. And I could do other link to events queries on top of that as well, of course. So as I execute this piece of code, this thing is an IKE observable provider that will translate this piece of code into whatever DataStift's query language is. And as I execute this, there we go. The Twitter firehose is streaming to us. I did Control-C just to limit the damage on my credit card. And so what you see over here is that's the language that they have. They have a language that's a little bit thick of parentheses, apparently. But so you see, like, twitter.user.followers_count is larger or equal to 10, and twitter.text contains good. So as you can see, you can now take, like, those link to event queries, send them somewhere else, but the way you get the data back is actually not by doing a for each loop. Instead, what you're doing is you're doing a subscribe. You're saying, that's the query, I want to subscribe to it. Send the user intent to the remote server, where it actually executes, and then stream the results back. Every time a new tweet comes in, this piece of callback code that's sitting over here executes. So it's a callback-based system. In fact, you know, I can show you another example that's local, a local example here. Let me see if I can find it easily. I think I can. Over here, in fact, I need to elevate this guy in order to run that. And I can open the project called WMI. And this is actually a link to WMI events implementation. And of course, you know, as most system designers like to do, people invent their own query languages. So WMI has done exactly the same in order to filter everything in the Windows Management Instrumentation repository, as well as events. WMI has events that can tell you when a process is started, when the power goes low. Like, Windows can notify your process about all of those things, and you can write queries that run actually as close to that infrastructure as possible, somewhere deep inside the WMI code. So what's going on here is I basically want to observe process start traces, as you can see, and I just want to get the ones that are notepad.exe. Let me actually start by getting all the process start traces without doing a filter. I want to get the process names and the process IDs, and then I want to do as observable to basically execute another piece of query locally. So everything on top needs to go to WMI because they have a way to query. But timestamping, they don't know how to do. They don't have a primitive for timestamping in their world. So I can go to as observable, and then what I get here is all of reactive extensions, including buffering, windowing, timing out, delaying, all of those things which WMI doesn't necessarily know about. Just like in link to SQL, you may do things in link to objects locally that you can't remote. So I'm going to do some timestamping just to associate a datetime offset value with each individual element in the stream. And here you see my superior UI skills, which involves drawing dots in this particular case, which happens to coincide with the Windows 8 progress animation. So to me, that's retro style. It's a little joke. So what you have here is something that most likely will do something. Oh, there we go. Like, I'm just running this thing. My UI is alive. It's asynchronous. It's actually pumping. And whenever a process is started on the local machine, that filter that's actually passed to the WMI infrastructure will forward the event to me. Apparently, the search filter host.exe decided it had some work to do. So that thing was actually started. The system is surprisingly calm, which I think is a good thing. But like, if I start like some other things like calculator, task manager, notepad, you see like the events are coming into my application. And so now WMI is actually sending all of those events to me. Now say that I want to filter them. I want to say where the process name equals notepad.exe. As you can see now, we have a where clause in here in WQL. WQL is a SQL dialect that they use in WMI. And so now, if I start calc, we shouldn't see anything forwarded. Our process, the CLR, never saw the calc instance coming to us. It was filtered out remotely, in this case somewhere low in the system. This could also be used on remote machines. WMI can work on remote machines. So say you do data center monitoring using this, and you want to basically detect whenever Trojan.exe virus is actually started on any of your machines on 5,000 computers, you don't want to do the first query where you get all of the system events of all the machines in the whole data center. Because what's going to happen is that your server that's monitoring the infrastructure is going to go down, right? Like, that is not the kind of thing you want to happen. So what you want to do is you want to push the filters to all the individual machines in the infrastructure. And so now you can do that using Link. So as I start some Notepad instances over here, what you will see is that Notepad comes actually true. Takes a while. It's actually, there's some throttling mechanism in WMI, but so you see that things are actually coming through. One more just for fun and giggles. Oh, beautiful. So what happened here is that the filtering happened remotely. The timestamping happened in the local process. That's what I did with the timestamp operator using Rx over here. I could do more, of course. I could do things like, for example, I want to get statistics of the number of notepads started every window of 5 seconds. So I could do something like buffer this thing with time spans of 5 seconds and then select B goes to B.count. Okay? So every 5 seconds, this is going to print notepad start statistics. Okay? So as I run this thing now, still the filtering is happening remotely, but the querying for the buffering is happening locally using Rx. And so there were no notepad instances. Let me now start some notepad instances. That's kind of the fun part of the demo. So there we go. I could actually start 12 notepad instances in those 5 seconds. Likely one will have leaked to the next window. No, okay, that's good. So as you can see, it's a fun game to do. You know, Mark Krasinovich might like it as well for like pressing the limits of the system. He has a blog post about that. So, you know, this might be a good demo case for that. In fact, I once had a problem. This laptop actually has a calc key to start the calculator. I put another laptop on top of it and was basically drawing a cascade of calculators, which was a really beautiful example of using Rx. So, and there we go. We closed all of them as well. So let's go back to the slides one more time and talk about a few more things here. The iScheduler abstraction, I talked about it in my talk about Rx. This is really to control where things happen. I don't have too much to tell about this just yet because we are still noodling around with it a little bit more in the cloud context, but here's a kind of a sampler of what you could do with it. If you look at this link to SQL query that uses the Northwind data context, and you can substitute it to link to a lot of other things as well, including entity framework, you know, OData, whatever. If you look at Northwind data context, it's a generated proxy that actually happens to contain the entry point for the schema. Means that you can dot into products, categories, suppliers, all of those things. That's beautiful. So you get nice IntelliSense by doing so. However, it also encapsulates where things happen. And as I've shown before, those two things are really orthogonal. It happens in the context of SQL. Typically, you send your query to a different machine, to a different process, and all of those kind of things. So, can't we separate those things out? Well, using the iScheduler, in Rx, we already have something to run work somewhere else. It's called ObserveOn. For those of you who weren't in my talk, the basic idea is, if you have a stream which gives callbacks on a certain thread, but you want the callbacks to happen on a different thread, you can say something stream.observeOn different thread. And the messages are forward posted to a different thread, where there's a message loop that actually pumps them. So what if we did something like remote on or remote to that takes in a nice scheduler and says, I'm going to basically run all of that work somewhere else. So I'm going to decouple, press too much again, the what from the where. And so here, Northwind data context would no longer know about where things are running. It would only know about the query translation aspect. What's the schema? It has a unit price, it has a product name, it has like, you know, order statistics, all of those things in Northwind. But then when the time comes to execute it, you have to say where to run it, which could, by the way, be a farm of servers. You could say a remote on SQL scheduler of server 1, server 2, server 3, the whole Azure data center, whatever. Like a whole replica set. So the scheduler could encapsulate also distribution of work as opposed to just a single connection string. Now, We can do slightly more with this, and actually the demo isn't quite working because I have some internet connectivity issues, but I will actually walk you through some PowerPoint slides showing you what I mean here. If you think a little bit about the way Link2SQL works, just think about it. You write some code in C sharp, okay? It's a sunny day, you're writing some Link2SQL code. What happens with your textual input? At some point, the C sharp compiler says, ah, that's beautiful, I'm going to take it into an AST, which represents the C sharp language. Happens to contain a query expression, and you happen to assign that to an expression tree, system.link.expressions. What does the C sharp compiler do? It takes its internal tree representation and makes an expression tree representation out of it. So I have two expression trees here. The one that's in the C sharp compiler, the one that's talking to system link expressions. Next, my link provider at runtime takes the expression tree and turns it into a CLR representation of an expression tree, an AST, that's actually used to represent the SQL. This thing is again going automatically, so ignore it for just a second. So the T-SQL representation, the object model, is just there to send the T-SQL to a different machine. So we basically print, this is going to reveal the secrets. Stop it. How do you stop this? I will just go back. good. So where was I? So we had your local T-SQL expression, just an expression tree object model. You do a toString on it, and you get a string back which contains T-SQL. So we've gone from link syntax in your C-sharp file through various expression trees, three expression tree representations. We've actually gone to a T-SQL string. Now you send it on the wire, and SQL Server takes it in, makes an AST out of it, makes a query plan out of it, makes other trees out of it to execute it. Why did we go through all the hoops of all those trees? Like, people that are really supporting all the green things, you know, in the world will not like us killing so many trees. Can't we do with less trees? Can't we just pick up the trees and transport them to some other place? Which maybe green people will not like either, transporting trees, but anyway. So that's what I want to try to do here. So what I have here is a little piece of code using Rx, but it doesn't really matter if it's Rx or anything else. It's a link expression. It actually can be represented as an expression tree, as we've seen. Now, what if we took that expression tree and, for example, serialized it as JSON, which is also a tree-shaped structure. You could also use XML if you like that better. And then on the other end, in this case, in JavaScript, for example, we rebuilt that whole thing into the target language. So we're shipping the expression tree as opposed to some string that represents some weird query language that you have to parse again on the other side. So why can't we lift those expression trees to the other side? And so here's an example of something we've actually built, and I hope to do some demos on Channel 9 about that in a couple of months. But so what you have here is the query server. In fact, we do have an implementation that's based on what I'm describing here today in our products. It's called Stream Insight version 2.1, actually has expression tree shipping in it. So it basically takes an expression tree that's written locally, lifts it up, and runs it on a different machine. So that's actually something that's shipping today based on the work we've actually done. This was actually the prototype of that actually showed the capability to convince management to do that kind of stuff. So we have a query server, which is a chat server. It's connected to the cloud through this beautiful UTP-5 cable, and it has a little globe to denote the fact it's connected to the world. Now I have Alice and Bob. Alice and Bob are not evil or good or something like the cryptographers like to use. It's just two nice names. So Alice is on top here. That sounds wrong. So Alice is on the top of the slide here and actually does service.getStreamOfChat. She's connecting to the server and actually wants to talk to Bob. But she speaks French. So she also wants everything that Bob says to be translated into French. So Alice wants actually to connect. So I'm going to use this new feature that ships with, you know, the next version of PowerPoint. It's called PowerPoint Visual Studio Edition, so we can set breakpoints and slides. It doesn't do anything. But so you did F9 onto that piece, and you actually executed this code by using F10. So we're stepping through this slide in the debugger, and so we're getting the stream called chat from the server. What this does, it connects to the server and creates a local proxy object to that guy. So we have a connection established at this point. Now I have a query that says, from the messages in the chat room, I want to get the messages that are from Bob, and I want to translate the text in the message to French. What's going to happen now is this thing is translate it into an expression tree that's sitting over there. It's really sitting behind the text box because Alice doesn't see that. She doesn't freaking care how it works. But so I'm sort of revealing the secret here. And to select with a where and all of that stuff. Classic expression tree. Now when you do subscribe, because link is lazy, only at the point of subscribe you're going to do stuff. And in fact, this connection only happens in subscribe as well. But for the animation, I just sort of made it a little bit more eager. And at this point, we would connect, and we would actually do subscribe, and we would actually send the expression tree to the other side as a whole. So the expression tree is sitting there now. That's exactly how that piece of code looks. And now what we're going to do here is what we get back on the other side is talk, which is an object that you can subscribe to. So now we have a connection established. In this case, the prototype was using WebSockets, which is also a little hard to get running on my machine currently. But so you can think of any kind of transport. In Stream Inside, they use different transport mechanisms. It doesn't quite matter what the transport is. But so now I have a talk entry point. Now we have Bob. He's at the bottom of the slide. Let's correct myself. And so this guy is now going to connect to the chat room as well. We have set a breakpoint in this case in JavaScript. This is using Rx for JavaScript. And he actually wants to get messages whenever something changes in the text box. So he's actually writing a link query. Whenever something changes in the text box, throttling, people who've been to my previous talk have seen this kind of code before. He wants to do an onNext in the chat room to send his message to the chat room, right? He wants to say the message comes from Bob, and this is the text. Of course, modular spoofing protection, all of those kind of things. So we step through it. We get a proxy again in the first phase to that chat object. And now we're going to run this query. When we run this query, you know, all that's happened is that we basically subscribe to it. The user hasn't typed anything yet, but we've expressed the intent of eventually sending data to the server. Now Bob types, "Hello, Alice." The breakpoint is hit because the local event fired, and what you see is "Hello, Alice" in the tooltip. A Visual Studio PowerPoint edition has tooltips as well. So what's going to happen now is we're going to do an onNext of "Hello, Alice" over the wire. So there we go, from Bob, "Hello, Alice," goes all the way there, and now percolates through the query. It goes through the where class, it passes the where class, it goes to the select, off to the translation service, because Alice actually wanted to get French back. We get "Bonjour, Alice," and "Bonjour, Alice" now travels on the wire to the other side where the breakpoint is hit, and it renders in the UI. So this is actually taking the expression tree that is all the filtering logic for the chat room over the wire, as opposed to sort of communicating bits and pieces, saying, "I want to talk to Bob, send the string Bob to the other side. I want to translate things in French. I need an API call for French." Like, why don't you take up the entire expression tree, which includes things like the Bing Translate API call, like that the other side happens to know about? So this is actually something we've been noodling around with quite a bit. I can show you that expression tree serialization actually works, but that's kind of the boring part of the demo. It's just showing that JSON is being produced. But so if you actually play around with Stream Inside V2.1, which is actually available on the download center, there are some licensing aspects to that, and I don't know anything about licensing, so don't ask me anything about that. But Stream Inside V2.1 uses exactly this technique inside to take up reactive extensions queries and host them in the server. They basically take the expression tree and ship them to the other side. So this technique is being used. It's actually in production today, and we're actually using it in various internal assets as well in different data centers. So I want to wrap up with one more thing. Maybe some of you have seen it before. Link to the unexpected. What I have here is something called Solver Foundation. It's a constraint solver. It can basically take in this weird syntax, which I've forgotten the name about, and this thing actually represents a business problem. In this case, the business problem is to decide how much oil to order in two countries. This is a table you actually get from the business guys. They say, if you order oil in Saudi Arabia, it's $20 per barrel. Saudi Arabia is only 15. The maximum we can order there, though, due to transportation and other reasons, you know, regulatory reasons, for example, is 9,000 over there, 6,000 over there. And then there are refining percentages, like how good is the oil for certain purposes. Saudi Arabia, well, the oil is much better as jet fuel, but if you order things from Venezuela, 40% of it is better to be used as gasoline. So the refinement percentages are different. Now, what I want is for my production plant, as you can see over here in this whole picture, I need at least 2,000 barrels of something. I need 2,000 barrels, that's in the constraint section over there. I need 2,000 barrels of 0.3 times Saudi Arabia, that's gasoline. So I need 2,000 barrels of gasoline, 1,500 of jet fuel, and 500 of lubricant. That's what I need in order to get my factory going. If you feed this to Solver Foundation, they will try to find an optimal solution, just using algebraic manipulation and all sorts of mathematics. So they will actually try to solve this problem. But the problem is we want to minimize, and basically meeting those requirements, we want to minimize over there, where's my thing, the total cost. If you select SA number of barrels in Saudi Arabia, that's going to cost you 20. You need to add that to 15 times the number of things you choose in Venezuela. Please minimize that cost. While I actually want to get that refinement percentage for my plant, that's the maximum number of barrels that comes from the table, and I don't want to send oil back. I don't want to have negative barrels. That's kind of ridiculous if I have a factory to send oil from Venezuela to Saudi Arabia, because that would optimize my cost. That's nonsense. So this syntax I don't understand. However, it's a filter and a sorting operation. So why can't we just put some link layer on top of that? Why can't we say, please create me a model of two decisions, two double values that you have to fill in. Those are my percentages of orders in the different countries, the number of barrels I want to order. And then I just encode everything using a where clause, because that's really what I'm doing. I'm asking for the Cartesian product of two doubles, like all those points, which are even not enumerable because they're the real numbers. Like for all those points, find me a point where those conditions actually hold. And do so by ordering them, like that infinite square number of values, order them by the cost and get the top one. It's not going to do that. It's not going to enumerate all the real numbers. It can't. It's impossible. People have proven that. So instead, what it's going to do symbolic manipulation of this whole query. That's what Solver Foundation does. But the thing is, I don't want to learn that language on the left. It's purely a syntactic convenience to be able to use the thing on the right. Have also type checking. I can't compare Venezuela to Bart. Like, that doesn't make sense. C-sharp is going to tell me on the left-hand side, you can write that, and there is going to be an exception coming out of Solver Foundation you've never heard about, saying, like, unexpected type on line number 15. Like, okay, yeah, I don't quite know what that means. So that's actually what we're doing here. In order to solve it, and that's going all the way back to the first slide, solving the problem is not doing get enumerator, because you only get one value back. It's not enumerating the whole domain and sort of saying, like, this is the most optimal thing. This is slightly less optimal. It just has one solution. It's not subscribing to it either. It's not a stream of things. So the way to leave the monad, in this case, of Solver Foundation, is by calling solve. You basically say on that whole thing, dot solve, and what you will get back is a task of the model. Task, because Solver Foundation may take a long time, so you want to do maybe it asynchronously, so that you don't have to block for that thing to actually be done computing. And so that's what we're doing here. So we can actually hook that up even further. I won't talk too much about that, but you can totally envision this thing being nested in a bigger query that's basically reactive. Whenever the prices change in any of the countries, please update this, you know, decision point and send a mail to the admin to cancel orders and create new orders, because it's now cheaper to order them in different countries. So you could actually nest that whole thing in a reactive extensions query and basically parameterize the decision problem using the things you get from, in this case, the price monitor, which is maybe related to some stock exchange or whatever kind of service that tells you what the latest value of barrels of oil is. So just to finish up or wrap up, this is the last demo, let's just show you an example of this in practice. So here we go. It's actually going to use Z3, which is a pretty similar tool compared to Solver Foundation, written by Microsoft Research. It's actually the thing used in a lot of compilers and tools that prove the correctness of code. For example, the hypervisor in Windows Server is actually proven correct with regards to isolation between the different virtual machines by using Solver Foundation Z3. And there they actually say, like, accesses to this memory should not be possible by people in that other space. And so they give all the constraints that they know of the implementation, and then that thing proves that this thing is satisfiable or not satisfiable. satisfiable meaning there is a security branch, not satisfiable meaning like we couldn't find any case for which memory access is invalid. So like they use that for all sorts of things. Also, things like, for example, PEX, the unit test explorer mechanism that we actually have, also uses C3 to actually find paths through your code that lead to different blocks being covered. They basically give all the conditions to C3, and C3 says if X is 5 and Y is 7, this piece of code is actually being reached. So generate a unit test that feeds in those two things, and you get code coverage for it. So what I'm doing here is I'm basically walking up to Z3. I'm creating a problem with three symbols, three unknowns. This is really for the high school students who actually want to cheat on their exam and say, like, I got this weird thing here that I need to solve for my teacher. Let's just add it in link, you know, like every high school student knows link today. And so you just write your exam thing into link syntax, and then you just press F5, and it will solve this set of inequalities. It will actually spawn up, and here we go. If x1 is 0, x2 is minus 2, and x3 equals 1, this set of conditions over here holds. Okay, so I've solved it. Now, here's the next one. What's the next one? That's something that comes from an airplane. It's a Sudoku. Sudoku is just a constraint problem, right? Like, I know those 20 cells that have been filled in. Here they are, like on row 1 and column 3, the value is 2. Row 1 and 6, the value is 1, and so on. And then there is a whole bunch of other constraints in Sudokus. Every cell is between 1 and 9. Things have to be unique on rows and columns and in those blocks. Like, there's a lot of constraints implied by the fact we're doing a Sudoku. So as I execute this thing, here we go. There's the solution to my Sudoku. It basically passes in everything. And we're just using convenient link syntax to express the problem, have type checking, IntelliSense, all of those things. Like if I dot into the Sudoku, I get to see all the cells, the rows, and the columns. But so this thing is actually sending it to Z3, and they know how to actually evaluate that. Maybe they're just doing like a brute force scan of all the possible Sudokus trying to find a solution. I don't know. I don't care. I just could use link at the end of the day. And that's basically what motivates me, is using link for everything. So there is some related content. The first one actually violates relativity because it goes backwards in time, but thanks to videos, you can actually still watch it. So that's my talk about reactive extensions. I will be around at Ask the Experts or whatever, you know, events are here where people can meet me. So you can find me over there. You can also come to, maybe that was a joke in my previous talk, if you come to the Belgian Country Drink tonight, and in fact I don't have invitations unfortunately, you can talk to me the whole night about like everything link and reactive extensions related. I don't drink alcohol, so I always sound intelligent, which is a competitive advantage on parties where people do drink. So please find me if you have more questions. I will be around over here as well, so please come and see me. There are some mandatory slides. Here's a RESX file in PowerPoint style. It's called resources. We also have evaluations. Please complete your eval. Tell us what you liked and what you didn't like. And we also have this company logo at the end of the talk. So thanks for your attention. Hope to see you again.